It's good to be back again. We're going to read from the scriptures a few verses, not many, in John chapter 6, and then we're going to speak about, history, but I'll tell you more detail. John 6, this is the Lord Jesus Christ, from verse 32 of John 6. Then Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." Then they said to him, "Lord, give us this bread always." And Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will by no means cast out. For I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. This is the will of my Father who sent me, that of all he has given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up at the last day. And this is the will of him who sent me, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day." Both those last two verses are, of course, true. And yet some people find it hard to grasp both of them, as we might see this evening amongst many other things. The series is 500 Years of the Gospel in England. This is the ninth of the 12 talks. The Light of the Gospel, part three. We saw in part one the great awakening God brought, a work of under Whitfield and the Wesleys and many others, and thrilling times where the gospel burst forth into our land. We saw last time how that looked at the effects that had on William Carey and others, at the beginnings of the modern missionary movement to spread the gospel then through the world. We come back today to parallel that section, but to look at what happened in Britain. I've got down here in England, 1765 to 1851. I can't quite remember why I've got that as a starting date, because I don't think it occurs here, but it's that sort of time. We're still in the Great Awakening. Wesley's still preaching, etc. Whitfield has gone to the Lord, or about that time. And going on to the middle of the 19th century. The first half of the 19th century was a time of the greatest growth and influence of nonconformity. The Great Awakening and then a revival, a continuing revival, really around 1800 and the years around there, which has often been missed by church historians because no one was really writing it up. It wasn't associated with any particular big names. But this occurred and it had great influence on many nonconformists and even, as we're going to see, on the Church of England. And as a result of that, but also then in reaction to it, many movements and people rose up and began who are still with us or who we need to continue and return to after 1850, good and bad alike. I think you'll be able to tell the one from the other, at least from my viewpoint. I want to start with evangelicals in the Church of England, because it's important we do this. The face of the nation was changed by certain men, MPs and people close to them who had, or people in the House of Lords, had influence over the laws of the land, and as Christians were determined to use that influence for good. So you had a group of men called the Clapham Sect, that was what they were called by others, John Venn, curate at Holy Trinity, Clapham in South London, the son of Henry Venn, who is later known as Henry Venn of Huddersfield. We looked at him in the Great Awakening. He became rector there in 1792, the year that Carey went out to India. And he gathered around him a group of chiefly prominent and wealthy evangelical Anglicans, recruited heavily from St. Edmund Hall at Oxford and Magdalen College, Cambridge, including Charles Simeon had been was the rector there and very influential. They included Venn and Simeon, William Wilberforce, Zachary Macaulay, the father of the historian, who was a writer and philanthropist, Granville Sharp, who we'll come to in a moment, and Henry Thornton, who was an economist, a banker, a philanthropist, and the MP for Southwark. And they founded various things. They founded a journal called the Christian Observer, edited by Macaulay. They founded Freetown in Sierra Leone in 1787, originally Granville Town, the first major British colony in Africa, whose purpose was the abolition of the slave trade, the civilization of Africa and the introduction of the gospel there. Interesting to note the order, because when Carey went out to India 5 years later, he put the gospel first, and not civilization or the abolition of anything, although later he worked for both. The Church Missionary Society, I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong, but that was their perspective. Church Missionary Society, Wilberforce, Venn, Simeon, in the last lecture we saw them founding that, British and Foreign Bible Society in 1804 with Thomas Charles of Bala. And one of the great works they did was the abolition, they brought about by the influence, the abolition of the slave trade and in the end of slavery itself. Granville Sharp took up the cause of a man who'd run away as a slave off a boat, and his master had taken him back on board, and he got a writ of habeas corpus and got him delivered, and a judgment that any and every slave in England could be set free if they could be brought before a court. And then Wilberforce met Granville Sharp. Wilberforce was the MP for Yorkshire from 1784 to 1812, and began this 20-year campaign. The slave trade was finally abolished by Parliament in 1807. They then moved on to campaign for the complete abolition of slavery in the British Empire, which was achieved by the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, 3 days before Wilberforce died. And then you have a man like the 7th, you can understand, I'm only giving you sort of headings almost, aren't I? The 7th Earl of Shaftesbury, Tory MP for Woodstock from 1826, behind all sorts of legislative changes, 1828, reformed the lunacy laws to stop people just locking up their relatives and getting court orders when they weren't mad at all, which people did, 1833 and onwards, the Factory Acts, restrictions on working hours and children's employment. In 1842, the same thing for the mines in the Mines and Collieries Act. 1851 and onwards, bills to prevent boys being sent up chimneys. All these things, as the Industrial Revolution was at its height and the mills were opening, the collieries were opening, the factories were opening everywhere, and people were just being exploited. And he was at the forefront of Parliament legislating to stop exploitation. They weren't against free trade, they weren't against capitalism, they were against exploitative capitalism. It's been called sort of state paternalism. Well, that's right, the state is a father looking after its children, not telling them what to do, but stopping other people from exploiting them. He set up in 1844 the Ragged School Union, schools for poor children, begun by volunteers. Someone this afternoon was mentioning the one in Bury, who still says Ragged School Union. He was also strongly opposed to Roman Catholicism, to the Oxford movement, which we're coming on to, and any Romanism or ritualism amongst Anglicans. Then we need to move to somewhere very else. In fact, we need to move to America briefly. God was sending revival in many times and places. In 1799 to 1801, there was a true revival in Kentucky and Tennessee, and the Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists joined together to set up what they called camp meetings. It was a fairly rural, sparsely populated area, so they'd say, well, there's going to be a meeting at a certain place for a week, and any minister who can would come and minister and just gather the people together from their little places in the outback, as it were. But these meetings began to be taken over by fanatics who claimed that the sign of God's working was that people would prostrate themselves and cry out. And they began also to preach for immediate decisions for Christ, and then told people who had made such a decision that they were now Christians, and immediately inviting them to communion. Now, we're not unaware, are we, that that happens. What we have to realize is this is the first known occurrence in church history of anybody acting like this. This is a first. Many left, the Presbyterians. The revival fell apart, but the Methodists claimed to keep it going by man's work. So they introduced the practice of altar calls and claimed that, you know, the whole tone of this was, if you put enough pressure on people, they will say they've become a Christian, and then you say, well, you have become a Christian, and you treat them as if you've become a Christian, and it's the work of man can produce conversions. It's a different theology of salvation from ours, from the biblical theology. Charles Finney was a man who did much damage in America during this period, denied man's fallen nature, a straightforward Pelagian. And this theology was enormously influential in America, but it also in England it became influential among the Methodists. A man called Lorenzo Dow visited England in 1807 and encouraged two men called Hugh Bourne and William Clowes to adopt camp meetings. And the Methodist conference met and they rejected the idea. This great book, Revival and Revivalism by Ian Murray, I recommend that to anyone, to show you the difference between the two, to show you God does work in revival, but what men call revival sometimes often isn't. The Methodist conference, it is our judgment that even supposing such meetings to be allowable in America, they are highly improper in England and likely to be productive of considerable mischief, and we disclaim all connection with them. And so Bourne and Clowes left with others and formed what they called the Primitive Methodists. And they began to hold these, what they would then call protracted meetings, where you'd carry the meeting on while there was anybody there and put pressure on people to decide for Christ. Of course, people would leave, but the idea was while there were any there, you just kept pressurizing them to say that they were coming to Christ, and it was psychological pressure. And the Methodists, the ordinary Methodists, were opposed to this. One man wrote this: "A long conversation with Dr. Newton, that's not John Newton, last Friday has convinced me that the conference must legislate in reference to American innovations. A class of men exists among us who, if not efficiently superintended, will soon bring the regularly instituted ordinances of God into utter contempt. These men are always boasting of their doings and making little or nothing of sound and wholesome preaching. And in spite of the fearful declensions taking place in certain circuits, which sometimes since were made red hot with the ism, they go on in their own ways, no man forbidding them. I glory in real revivals of experimental and practical Christianity, but I abhor self-sufficiency and absurdity." You see what he's saying? People get red hot, and it seems that great work is going on, and then after a while it all falls apart and it proves to be a work of man and it brings disgrace on the true work of God. But of course this decisionist theology became normal, sadly, in the USA, and in the end we got very influential here through the influence of D.L. Moody and others, but that's in the next talk. What were the Baptists doing? Well, they were dividing. And combining, because there was still theological ferment, and they were growing. And this we mustn't miss. We'll come to the figures in the end, but between 1800 and 1850, Baptists grew by five times. And there was theological dissent amongst them from each other to some extent. The particular Baptist Union formed in 1813, but it was allowed general Baptist churches, non-Calvinistic Arminian churches, to join in 1832. They were only a small minority, but that was the year, of course, to allow that the 1689 confession was no longer enforced as a doctrinal standard. Some Arminian churches didn't join, and the Calvinistic churches, which didn't, continued in their existing regional associations. It's worth knowing that almost certainly there has never been a time in the history since the Baptist Union was founded where it included more than half of Baptist churches in the country. It's never been a great majority. The particular Baptist churches, whether in the Union, but no, the ones outside, were normally also strict Baptist in their communion, but there was movements around, and some were still hyper-Calvinistic, but they became some of them less so, but not all. And there was movement, but it's a movement of growth as people's theology developed. In the midst of this, you have William Gadsby, born in the Midlands in 1773, converted in 1790, becoming pastor of Back Lane Chapel in Manchester, which he immediately withdrew from the Yorkshire and Lancashire Association, because there were churches in it that he considered unsound. He called them Fullerite. We would call them straight down the line Calvinistic churches like this. But he was tinged with hyperism, but not to the extent that it stopped him being an evangelist who founded 29 churches in his lifetime. And the Gospel Standard magazine, which was the magazine of the hyper-Calvinists. but it's not quite the old hyperism. A man who can write in his hymn, "Bid the guilty him embrace," is not the old style hyper-Calvinist. And you need to read really about this complicated man. And if you go to Charlesworth, you can see his grave as well. But many, some examples. The 1829, the Suffolk and Norfolk Association of Strict Baptist Churches adopted hyper-Calvinistic articles, which they held at least in theory until 1949. In 1841, the Strict Communion Society set up in London, but strong in the north, which founded Manchester Bible College, which you wouldn't associate with that, I think, now. In 1846, the London Strict Baptist Association was founded. Baptists were, some were in regional associations, some in the National Union, and they were working things out, and theology shifted one way or the other in different churches. It'd be lecture upon lecture to give you a more complete picture. But the point is that God was at work and people were being saved. And there was life. It was the theological ferment of a living group of churches, of which there were thousands in the country. And then we come to some more beginnings. We have to take these two things together, the beginnings of Pentecostalism and dispensationalism. Now, Pentecostalism really began in about just after the beginning of the 20th century, but they would trace their roots to what these things we're going to see. A man called Edward Irving, a Scotsman who took on a struggling Scottish chapel in London, which suddenly all the posh people started going to. You'd have carriages drawn up along the road outside the door. He had fame as an orator. It's almost inexplicable how this happened. It became the fashionable place to go. A new chapel was quickly built for 1800 in Regent Square. But sadly, Irving was a man who was clearly unstable in his views. He was always looking for something new. He became convinced by the work of a Jesuit priest, Manuel Lacunza, writing under the assumed Jewish name of Joanne Jehoshaphat ben Ezra, that the second coming was very near, and he began to preach in 1827 on prophecy, and he would go through Revelation, and he'd link all in Revelation, taking it as if it was linear history from beginning to end, and linking everything to current events in a premillennial way. And as everybody who always seems to, who takes that view of history, whatever century they live in, they always end up with the view that their generation is about 1 year from the second coming, which does suggest there's probably something wrong with the model of interpretation, but I'm not going to go into that. He was influenced, in fact, by a man called James Hartley Frere, also the founder of modern premillennial school of prophetic interpreters, whose most influential work had been published the year before on the general structure of the apocalypse. And he wrote many other influential works. He founded a society, or the Society for the Investigation of Prophecy, in 1826 with Irving and Lewis Way of the London Jews Society. Interesting, you've got this Anglican man, this Scotsman in London, and a Jew who are setting up a society for the investigation of prophecy. Henry Drummond, who was influenced by Irving and Way, called a prophetic conference at his home, Albury Park in Surrey. It's a big home, in 1826, and these ran to 1830. About 40 people attended, almost all of them Anglican clergy. Meanwhile, Irving began to expect that as the time was near, and this view was not confined to Irving, this was a view that many held, really. John Ryland Sr., who opposed Carey going out to India, had held this view that here are the nations and the gospel's got to go to every nation, hasn't it, before Christ returns? How is it going to go to these nations when no one can speak their language and they can't speak ours? God is going to pour out another miraculous outpouring of tongues, real foreign languages, just before Christ comes. That was a view that was held. Irving held that view, but Irving being Irving, he began to, once having been convinced that that's going to happen, he began to expect it immediately to happen in his church, and it did. Or at least there was an outpouring of what was called tongues, which were actually just nonsense. But a lady called Margaret MacDonald in 1830 announced in a tongues message, which was interpreted, that Christ would be caught up the church so he would be caught up in a secret rapture before Christ returned to earth. This is the beginning of this teaching. We can date it. It started in 1830. Irving's services became chaotic. He began to preach the heresy of Christ's sinful flesh, for which he was expelled from the Church of Scotland. They had chaotic services with uncontrolled tongues. Often the prophets ran the service. He wasn't always even allowed to preach in his own pulpit. And he died aged 42. It's quite a tragic life, really. The Albany conferences were followed from 1831 to 33 by the Powers Court conferences at Powers Court House in Ireland. And this prophetic view of Revelation as linear history, expecting the imminent return of Christ, was the foundation of it all. Meanwhile, in 1827, a man called A.N. Groves in Ireland, in Dublin, had founded a group of believers from different churches who called themselves the Brethren. This is the beginning of the Brethren. J.N. Darby, who was a curate in the Church of Ireland, fell from his horse, was laid up while his leg healed with the Bible and certain writings of prophecy, though he later suppressed that fact. And in 1828, left the Church of Ireland, joined the Brethren, and after 1830 began to teach the secret rapture, followed by 7 years tribulation before Christ's return and then the millennium. And he also began to teach that the history of the world is a history of seven dispensations and that God works in different, wholly different ways in those dispensations, including the way that he saves sinners. And he attended the Powers Court conferences. Now, a man called B.W. Newton in 1831 founded a Brethren assembly in Plymouth and he wouldn't accept dispensationalism. And Darby divided it in 1845 over this doctrine and excommunicated everyone who wouldn't cut themselves off from the Plymouth Brethren, including George Muller in Bristol, founding his orphanages. And this became then the exclusive Brethren. They had a central meeting in London which ran the denomination. Darby effectively became the Pope of it. And it's ironic that that which was set up as a protest against denominationalism became doctrinally the most tightly controlled denomination of all. I know a man in Christ, not me, who has in recent times been expelled from his Brethren assembly when he gave up on dispensationalism and has it in writing that he's been called a heretic. Just because he won't accept one particular interpretation of the events that precede and follow the second coming of Christ. It's important to notice that when the Pentecostals did start, they looked back to Irving. And taking on board the idea of tongues, they also took on board the dispensationalism. And that's why Pentecostals are dispensationalists as well as the Brethren. And you see, these people are still with us, aren't they? Pentecostals, charismatics, well, you can trace a lot of it back to Irving. Now for something completely different. Another movement, the Oxford movement. This is in the Church of England. There were evangelicals in the Church of England, like the Clapham sect and many others. And then there was the broad church, the ones who were indifferent to doctrine. Dr. Matthew Arnold, headmaster of Rugby, was a leading light in promoting this sort of view. He said, the Church of England is a human institution for the purpose of enabling people to satisfy their religious impulses. In other words, people want to worship a God, and the Church of England has been set up so that they can do it, and we can all do it together in churches. John Keble, who was a poet, opposed both of these views. He began to write, a book called The Christian Year in 1827, devotional poems, including for saints' days. In 1831, he became professor of poetry at Oxford. And Parliament at this time was trying to deal with certain anachronisms, including the fact that in Ireland, where virtually everyone was a Roman Catholic, the Church of England had many dioceses which had bishops and which had with tiny little numbers of people attending the churches. And they said, we're going to combine some of these. And they passed an Act of Parliament to do it. And Keble stood up at the Assize Sermon, which he was preaching in Oxford in 1833, and preached a sermon against this called National Apostasy. He said, this is apostasy if the church is being controlled by the state like that. State can abolish bishops? And he began to publish tracts for the times, with an emphasis in these influential tracts on sacramentarianism, on apostolic succession, the idea that true ministry is handed down by a succession, unbroken succession of laying on of hands from the apostles. He began to preach works as well as faith for salvation. It was another outbreak, as we have in this country periodically, of Catholicism without the Pope. He was joined by Edward Pusey and by John Henry Newman, who's certainly been in the news this week, hasn't he, and others. In 1841, Newman published Tract 90, where he tried to prove that the 39 Articles were Catholic and that not Protestant, and therefore that Cranmer, when he was burnt at the stake, because Cranmer wrote the 39 Articles, was actually protesting against something that wasn't really there, and he misunderstood Roman Catholicism. I think Cranmer would probably had a better understanding of it than Newman did. The tract was condemned by the university authorities. Further tracts were forbidden. Pusey was suspended for teaching transubstantiation. Newman moved to Rome in 1845. But it became a very influential movement, not just in Oxford, it began in Oxford. Many churches introduced altars where the communion table was put back against the wall, and the priest therefore had to do things with his back to the congregation. We're used to lots of Anglican churches being high, aren't we? But you have to remember, this was the beginning of it. It wasn't there before this. It hadn't been there probably since the time of the Civil War, certainly. And statues were being set up, crosses, incense, sung services, anthems, private confessions, all of this beginning at this time in the Church of England, all in imitation of Rome. One writer puts it like this. He says, talking of evangelicals here really, this essentially Protestant nature of the Church of England was exhibited especially in the doctrine of justification by faith, the paramount authority of Scripture, a high regard for the reformers, and an unambiguously Protestant understanding of the 39 Articles and the Book of Common Prayer. You had those, you had the latitudinarians who couldn't really care less, and then you had the Oxford movement. The Tractarians set out to challenge the doctrinal and theological consensus which then prevailed within the Church of England, and to argue that the true identity of the Church of England was essentially Catholic, not Protestant. And they still argue that today. They began to use language that people didn't use. Apostolic succession, priesthood, Eucharistic sacrifice, real presence, absolution. They were pushing popery, that's the word I want, without the Pope. But many began to move to the Catholic Church. Following Newman, and especially following in 1850, the Gorham case. George Gorham was ordered by the Privy Council to be instituted in his living in Devon after the Bishop of Exeter refused it. The Bishop refused it because Gorham, who was an evangelical, denied baptismal regeneration. And the Privy Council ordered, that's the highest court in the land, ordered that he had to be instituted. And many said this is national apostasy again. And they left for Rome, including the future Cardinal Manning, who became head of the Roman Catholic Church in England. What was happening with the Catholics? Well, there was movements to try and take away some of the penalties that had been imposed 100 years before. An act in 1778 allowed Roman Catholics to own property and inherit land, and the reaction was riots in Scotland and the Gordon riots in London against allowing this. But in 1782 there was an act which allowed the establishment of Roman Catholic schools and bishops, and in 1829 the Catholic Relief Act meant that now Catholics could be elected to Parliament and become judges. Well, we have to remember, though, that in a population of about 10 million in England, Roman Catholics at this point, certainly in 1800, were under 100,000, less than 1% of the population. By 1850, there were 750,000, not because they had lots of children, but because of the Irish potato famine. 1844 and the years that followed, the potato crop failed. Irish people, vast numbers, were starving. They left Ireland in droves. Many went to America, we know that, other parts of the world. And many, of course, came across to England. And some there was a parish somewhere in Lancashire. I read this a while back. Can't remember exactly where, in Manchester, I think, where in the time when one particular priest was the parish priest, his congregation multiplied by 12. Now, the English Roman Catholics have been very much a keep our head down, do things in private, don't rock the boat. Their churches were quite austere, quite plain. And the Irish were completely different. And it was full of statues, their churches, worship of Mary, gaudy statues painted in bright colours, which they kiss at frequent intervals. And they brought this idea across into England, and the whole face of Catholicism changed. They were also very, very pro the Pope ruling everything, which the English Catholics had learnt not to be, because it was considered treason if you said it. But in fact, it was more an upper class movement by this time, Roman Catholicism anyway, or middle class at least, upper middle class. And suddenly this whole change came about. We can't follow it up today, but we can follow it up later. This change of the face, but vastly, suddenly Catholicism became a big group, a big part of professing Christianity. And then you have the rise of theological liberalism, or as it could be called also, modernism. Most Presbyterian churches by early 1800 had become Unitarian, that is, Arian. They were denying the deity of Christ. And some congregational churches also. The Baptists were not affected by this. In 1836 in Germany, a man called G.F. Strauss wrote A Life of Jesus. Strauss believed that everything supernatural in the Gospels was myth. And so you've got to separate out all these miracle stories and everything, which couldn't have happened, could they? Because miracles don't happen, from really this teaching of this man, Jesus of Nazareth. And so it began a movement in Germany to start with, which was called the Quest for the Historical Jesus. It's a bit like, a quest for the Holy Grail. You're never going to find it. And other lives followed, but this was liberalism in the churches, openly espoused, and particularly two things denied, that two cardinal doctrines of liberalism are that the Bible is not true and Jesus is just a man. Everything else flows from that. And this was now beginning to take over the theological seminaries in Germany. In our period, it hasn't come much in. In the next period, it came in like a flood into this country. We need to see it was beginning. These storm clouds are on the horizon. There are things happening here that are going to bear fruit, to change the metaphor, later on. But now something good. The City Missions Movement, a movement which aimed to establish mission halls in the poor areas of the cities. Usually what you had in a city or a large town was that the nonconformist churches were in the middle, where nobody now lived. Then you had the poor areas, what we call the inner city, where there were hardly any churches. Then you had the suburbs, where the richer Christians had moved out to. And poor people, therefore, found it hard to find a church and were put off by the perceived, at least probably rightly perceived, dress code, that they couldn't dress like these people going to church, and they just didn't come. And the City Missions Movement was a deliberate attempt to try to bring the gospel into these inner city, as we would call them, areas. It was founded by a man called David Naismith, who founded the Glasgow City Mission in 1826. That was the first. And then Liverpool in 1829, Edinburgh 1832, London 1835, Manchester 1837. Some of us know about the Chester City Mission, that was 1845. Others in between as well. 60 in total, 60 city missions, 60 cities in England and Scotland had missions. And David Naismith had started this. He also started in 1844, founded the YMCA, Young Man's Christian Association. The idea here was loads of people, as the Industrial Revolution exploded, moved in from the countryside, moved in from small towns and the farms, came into the cities, young men, to get work. They got work, but who was going to look after them spiritually? They were cut off from their churches at home. They were prey to all sorts of things, worldliness and gross sins. and to set up places where there would be halls where they could meet and have fellowship, and the gospel would be preached and they'd be helped and supported, is to reach these rootless young workers. That was what it was set up for. And so you see, some people were getting to grips with this. The Church of England in the next section more really had a great push to try and build churches in these kind of areas too. Some people were awake to the great demographic shifts that were happening in our country and saying, here are people who need the gospel. And that brings us to two final things. The first is the National Census on Religion. They're linked. National Census on Religion in 1851. If you wonder why there was never another one, you're going to find out. You know, we have a census every 10 years. Uniquely in 1851, attached to it was a census on what people did about church. And it was found, in answer to the questions there, that 49% of the population attended church at least monthly. We would say, wow, that's great. In those days, people, as we'll see, were saying only 49% monthly. They were really surprised by that finding. They were astonished by the finding that more people attended non-conformist churches than Anglican churches each week. They hadn't believed that. The government's never got to grips with how many non-conformist churches there are. Witness charity registration attempts. No, but the point is that Parliament and many people had defended the Church of England establishment on these grounds. It's the choice of the majority of English people. It should have more rights than non-conformists because it's the normal thing that English people do when they go to church. They go to the Church of England. Suddenly they found that wasn't true, which caused real earthquakes and again was a powerful push behind the Oxford movement, who was saying, the High Church movement, who was saying, no, the real reason for the Church of England is because it's an apostolic church and it's the true apostolic church. Let me give you the membership figures for these denominations. In England, the Wesleyan Methodists had 335,000. Most, their main area was to work amongst the urban working class, workers in towns. Congregationalists were 165,000. Their predominance was amongst the upper middle class, the professionals. It was considered, you know, if you're a professional person and you weren't Church of England, Congregationalism was respectable. Not Baptists, because you had to go under the water. Not Methodists, because they tended to shout things out and preach in the open air. But Congregationalism was sort of staid and stolid. Baptists, 140,000. They were mostly actually amongst the lower middle class, the clerks and that kind of people. They preached, amongst other things, of course, self-responsibility. Other Methodists were 102,000, mostly in the countryside, rural working class people. The trade unions came out of Methodism and they started in the countryside, remember, not in the towns. Tolpod and Martyrs and all that. All these denominations and groupings that had been around, though, in 1800, grew more than five times between 1800 and 1850. You see, underlying everything and easy to miss, there was an amazing work of God going on in this period. If God had continued to work in the way well, if you imagine if they multiply by more than five times in the next 50 years and the next 50 years, you'd end up with everybody's a Christian. It was an extraordinary, vast numbers of buildings were built in the next period also, as well. Great works of God. Mission halls maybe had 63,000 people in them. The growth there was still to come, not just city missions, but others setting up independent mission halls. And yet, everything in the garden wasn't rosy, and a quite perceptive writer spotted things which we can see he was right to spot. He put it like this. He said, even in the least unfavourable aspect of the figures, the most favourable, that isn't it, and assuming, as no doubt is right, that the 5 million people absent every Sunday are not always the same individuals, it must be apparent that a sadly formidable portion of the English people are habitual neglectors of the public ordinances of religion. He's surprised it's only 49%. More especially in cities and large towns, it is observable how absolutely insignificant a portion of the congregations is composed of artisans, people who earn their living by their hands. They are unconscious secularists, engrossed by the demands, trials, or pleasures of the passing hour, and ignorant or careless of a future. These are never or but seldom seen in our religious congregations. The present rate of church and chapel increase, that's buildings, brings before our view the prospect at no distant period of a state of things in which there will be a small deficiency of structures where to worship, but a lamentable lack of worshippers. Teeming populations often now surround half-empty churches, which would probably remain half-empty even if all the sittings were free. You had in many churches to pay a pew rent to have your pew. He says, it's evident that absence from religious worship is attributable mainly to a genuine repugnance to religion itself. He means Christianity, but he's talking from that perspective. He says, there is no attractiveness at first to them in the proceedings which take place within the church or chapel. All is either unintelligible or disagreeable. He had a point, didn't he? He was not so good on what to do about it, but he had a point. And we see that, don't we? And we've seen that from that day to this, that as cities have grown, the proportion of people who are going to church from that day to this has declined. It wouldn't hit 49% again, I'm sure, though they didn't do surveys after that. It probably stayed at that sort of level for a bit, but gradually it dropped off. And we find, sadly, that there were a lot of people, half the population of the country, really, at this time, couldn't care less about Christianity. Then when you start getting the attacks that come in the next period, much more than they're here, on the church, then the church starts to lose its way, and then things go downhill. And sadly, the next three talks, I haven't got dates for them yet, but to talk to Oliver, are going to be called, after these three with the light of the gospel, are going to be called the resurgence of the darkness, because, well, from that situation to this, that I think is a fair title. But one thing to say as we conclude, remember, this is England. This is not the world. I haven't dealt with Scotland and Wales and Ireland. I haven't dealt with Western Europe. But when we see, you could not give three talks from 1850 to the present day on Africa and call it the resurgence of the darkness. You'd call it the light of the gospel. God works in different places, in different times. And in many parts of the world, the gospel has spread vastly, and many multitudes have been saved since 1850, all over the world. But isn't it interesting that God used this country to send the gospel out? And once they were doing that, and missionary societies were going everywhere, parallel to what we've looked at today, and then the declension sets in here. But God has his times and his seasons and his purposes, and we must trust him for what he's doing.